Dear friends, my name is Isabel Abbott, and I am making this recording in my office. I feel a little guilty about stealing office time from a very important job of reading folders, but I know that this is long past due. It is Friday the 13th, and I hope that no ill will be attached to this date. Although I was brought up as a Methodist, baptized by a Methodist bishop, as a matter of fact, my first acquaintance with Quakerism came when I spent 4 years at Swarthmore College. During that period, I did not attend meeting for worship frequently, but I was aware of the Quaker philosophy. When our children were young, we always spent Sunday morning very comfortably reading the New York Times and drinking coffee, and from our strict upbringing, felt that the children certainly should go to Sunday school, so that we sent them by themselves 3 doors down the street. We did attend the usual Children's Day services at this congregational church and contributed modestly to the Sunday school upkeep. At that time, we were renting the downstairs apartment of a home owned by Newlin and Marion Smith, birthright Quakers from Swarthmore and Kutztown, Pennsylvania, respectively, both Swarthmore graduates. The Smith children went regularly to Cambridge meeting, and our children, after a bit, asked if they could not attend Cambridge Friends meeting. At that time, we were about to set off for 2 years in Pakistan, but we did promise that when we returned, we would go to Cambridge meeting. This we did in 1955, forsaking the comfortable Sunday morning coffees, since obviously we had to drive the children to meeting, and to sit with them during that painful period of silence before the children left for first day school. Actually, neither of us had any intention of joining the meeting, but my feelings, after a bit, I began to feel guilty about not doing anything, although the children were obviously profiting from their experiences at the first day school. I volunteered to serve on the first day committee. This was somewhat unusual, since non-members did not serve on committees at that time, but graciously the meeting consented to let me serve. This comfortable association continued for a number of years until someone on that committee decided that we really didn't need the first day school. The children should go to meeting for the whole hour and appreciate the general silence and messages. Philosophically, the prospect of sitting for a solid hour with restless children seemed intolerable to me, nor did I think that the children would profit from such a lengthy period. But as a non-meeting member, I could not oppose this with any veracity. So I joined, and I passed the membership procedure. My husband did not join, although he attended with me regularly. His father was a Methodist minister, and each of us felt that it would not be appropriate for him to change at that time. Somehow, the first day school survived in its present format. as the children grew older, I became involved in other meeting events. The Mayfair, Chuto Chapin's play reading group, which both Freeland and I enjoyed enormously. The Committee on Oversight and Fellowship. Probably I spent the most time and the greatest energy for the longest period of time in serving on the Cambridge Friends School trustees. This is the first year in many years on which I have not had that monthly Monday evening meeting, nor the personnel committee meetings and all of the other things involved in the running of what has been a very successful contribution to the life both of the meeting and to the Cambridge community in general. The most significant contribution in my mind which I was able to make to the meeting was to serve as the clerk of the committee which was to decide what course of action might be taken by the meeting to arrange its organization after the retirement of Elmer Brown. At that time, there was a group in the meeting who felt that there should be no replacement for Elmer Brown, but that all of the business and outreach and spiritual impact of the meeting should be handled by various committee members. Another group felt that this was an unrealistic supposition in a meeting as large and as diverse as that of Cambridge. Other professional commitments certainly would take precedence over the kinds of events over which Elmer Brown had regularly presided, and also the mere nitty-gritty work of keeping a presence which might be eagerly sought, and certainly has been eagerly sought, by many residents and attenders would be an important fact to be considered. This committee began as a group of acquaintances. There was a lawyer, a drama professor, both married, a middle-aged single woman, a young widow, I was the middle-aged widow, a young graduate student, another woman, young married, a French professor, varying ages, varying perceptives, varying backgrounds. We worked rather steadily and revised the plan which we eventually presented to the meeting for business. At that meeting, several suggestions were made from the floor, if I can use that term, and we went back and revised again. I remember before these meetings for business, I'd be so conscious of my responsibilities, I'd even think about what I might wear. Oh, no, that would be too loud. No, that would be too somber. And at all times, I was really very conscious of the fact that I'm not philosophically very spiritually involved, but that I must be very careful not to give offense to anyone. And eventually, the proposed plan was adopted by the meeting, and I think there have been since that time, adaptations to the original plan as the personnel of the so-called Resident Friends changed, and also as the perceptions of that role changed. The whole problem really, I think, had a great influence on me. This way of trying to be a chairman but not trying to run things, and to be very sensitive to the perceptions of others. Although I did have very strong convictions about what I thought was right. Friends might be amused by the fact that at this same time I was chairman of a professional committee, which of course ran things very differently, and we voted on what issue we would present or what issue would be decided. And I can remember at one of those professional committee meetings, the vote was 6-1 on the issue I've forgotten. And I said to the negative voter, now, Tom, do you feel comfortable about this? And as I said it in the back of my mind, I said to myself, Isabel, these Quakers are getting to you. But of course I didn't let on this little prospect to the professional committee. Controversies that I recall among the meeting have been one concerning how we should replace Elmer Brown and what style. Another over funds to remodel the meeting house so it would be more suitable to handle the great crowds of people we attract. Another, and I do recall that business meeting with great amusement, the occasion when it was brought up that we should write to the Friends meeting in California, to which our president at the time, Nixon, belonged, and suggest that he might be read out of the meeting. That business meeting went on for some time and was finally resolved by the statement that, well, we certainly would not like to have anybody tell us, particularly on the other side of the country, how to read out members of our meeting, but we should express our concern to the meeting in California about the views, actions, philosophy, etc., of our president, and that was indeed what we did. I think there is always a dichotomy, actually, between those who feel that resources should be used for social concerns and those who feel that resources should be used to improve facilities which will enhance our ability to provide social service. I must say that I tend to favor the latter view, and I'm happy to see that some sorts of compromises have been made. When I first attended Friends meeting, the kitchen, which sometimes would serve 50 or 60 people, was more poorly equipped than my own kitchen, which usually just serves 6 people. This has been a great improvement in aiding the outreach of the meeting. This long-term material improvement reminds me of the time when Newland Smith, and I was not a member at that time, wanted very much to have the meeting by that lovely large house which faces Brattle Street behind the meeting. I think at that time the price was something like $25,000 or $50,000. $50,000, I think. And, of course, remember this was 40, 50 years ago. The property would now be much more valuable and would be a great advantage to us. But at that time, those who felt that we should not invest in material improvements tended to prevail in the sense of the meeting. Newland and Marion Smith really had, I think, a great influence in that meeting, and certainly as landlords and good neighbors had an impact on our lives. They were really wonderful landlords. I can remember one Christmas morning when Newland called up and said, "Isabel, is your hot water heater on?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "Well, our toilet just flushed hot water, and we were wondering." Indeed, it was on, and we took care of the matter by running the washing machine quickly. And, oh, a time when Fenwick Smith, now the Boston Symphony second flutist, as a little boy, when I was learning to drive, called his mother to the window and said, "Come, let's watch Mrs. Abbott scrape," as she got out of the garage. But more than that, Newland and Marion were always so patient with us. We were not very, very well organized. They were. And yet, they respected our style, if you can call it that. And I remember that period during which we lived in their house very, very fondly. Among the other members of the meeting whom I remember very much, Susan Brooks, the epitome of the Quaker lady, Tudor Chapin, delightful, and Stuart. I treasure the friendship of people in the meeting, like Marilee and Andy Toll, Louise Alger, many, many others. It isn't fair to single out members whom we regularly see at this time. I have really a very humble attitude when it comes to talking about the spiritual experiences, because I really am not the spiritual type. I'm more of a Martha than a Mary. Some of the outstanding meetings for worship that I can remember, one in the Vietnam War, when Walter Grossman spoke about his rationale for not buying a button. At that time, there was a group who was going to Washington to protest the Vietnam War, and they were selling buttons to get support for this. And Walter said he opposed the Vietnam War, but he would not buy a button because to him it recalled Austria in the 30s when Hitler had invaded and Jews were required to wear buttons. And ever since that time, he had felt that such an identification was evil, even though wearing the button for the Vietnam War, he would not have considered evil. He simply could not bring himself to wear a button. Sometimes messages of Betsy Miller have been very much appreciated by me. I have enjoyed her recollections of her staunch Quaker family and its Bible reading. I've particularly enjoyed her scholarship, those times when she might take one or another of the French translations of the Bible and delineate their differences in selections of words, and also delineate the differences in the various newer English versions of the Bible. I've also been conscious of the fact that Betsy always feels that when the children are present, some appropriate message should be proffered for them to take with them. I feel uncomfortable at times in meeting for worship when people tend to spill out all their emotions on a platter to wobble like a jellyfish. This is just a personal feeling. I am a private person. But I have enjoyed those messages which cause me to think. I think meeting for worship requires a great deal of discipline. To sit down and not decide what you have to do tomorrow or what you should have done yesterday. And I try to make myself think useful thoughts and often will wind around a little sermon, discard that, wind up with another one, discard that, and sometimes have a whole meeting full of little sermons that I've designed without ever sharing them, discarding the ones I don't think are of very high quality. One of the fascinating things I do find about meeting for worship is the way someone will present an idea or a thought, and then another person later on will pick up that thread, and it's like weaving a mosaic. I appreciate the fact that most friends recognize that the meeting for worship should not be a debating society. Theologically, I appreciate the fact that there is great variation among the beliefs among the beliefs of friends. My late husband used to say that you could hear everything from sheer pantheism to outright fundamentalism in this meeting for worship, and that is indeed the case, and that's why I enjoy it, because of the diversity. Last week, the chaplain's table here at Tufts, a small group which meets and has little speakers on various religions, asked me to talk about Quakerism, and I presented the central beliefs and emphasized the variations among the various members, and also emphasized what I felt to be most central, namely the thought that God is in every man and we must seek for it in our relationships. This meeting turned out to be a real challenge because I had in this group a Hindu, a couple Muslims, a Baptist, a couple Catholics, and I was really asked some probing questions which I tried to answer, emphasizing the fact that the questions made me feel very humble. One was, do Quakers believe in immortality? And of course, some do, very much so, with the hereafter and the angels flying about. I personally do not. I feel that one's life is over when the mortal shell has departed, but that what one does in one's life can have an effect on other people, and that, in a sense, is, for me, immortality. Then I was asked, well, what about this? Did the Quakers believe if God was in every man, was it in animals and flowers, too? That question was from the Hindu. It was a hard one. To my knowledge, it is not the case. And then one of the Catholics asked me about missing a format in a meeting for worship. I miss the music, but I find the meeting for worship very comfortable. Another asked, well, what happens when people are in trouble? You don't have a rector or a priest. And so then I went through the various committee structures. But it was interesting to me how fascinated this group of, oh, maybe a dozen, of very, very mixed religious backgrounds were, and maybe some of them will show up at meeting for worship. I do think that the meeting does mean something to me, and I do, as I say, believe it's the God in every man which is the most central to me. I'm not a strict pacifist. Remember, a Swarthmore meeting almost fell apart during World War II because there were so many different views on what the meeting should adopt. But I do believe in peace, and I do believe in disarmament, so there's a dichotomy for you. I think the major strength of the Friends meeting is its diversity, its enormous attraction for young people. Some of them are still seeking and will drift off. Some of them will find a permanent home in the meeting, and some will serve to be forceful contributors. And I think this constant diversity is what will make the meeting survive and be strong. Most of the Protestant churches in this area have as their forces, if I can use that word, a pretty middle-aged group, and its attenders are middle-aged, whereas the balding heads and gray hairs in the meeting for Cambridge on any particular Sunday, the gray heads and the bald heads are in a minority, and I think this is a great strength. I think the weaknesses of the meeting might be sometimes preoccupation with one aspect or another aspect, and maybe there might be some hidden divisiveness, but I think that this is common in any kind of corporate group. My personal hopes for the meeting in the future would be for it to continue in its strength, to try and reduce the high emotionalism which seems to pervade some meetings for worship, and also to continue to improve facilities so that that can be a very effective meeting place for Friends at the year 2000 as well. I'm sorry that this really has not been exactly what the History Committee might want, but I hope that your other presenters will give you perhaps greater detail. I recall those Mayfair events. Incidentally, I find now the Mayfair, more adults are taking greater responsibility. At one time, there were always adults in the background, but it was the kids who were doing more of the work. That may reflect our society. On the growth of the neighborhood meetings, I guess they are a source of strength. I think that the smallness of them, to me, does not mean as much as the diversity I feel in the regular Sunday groups. Good luck with your project.